I'm talking to Janice Arnold-Jones, whom we have heard from before on Women's Focus. She's running for House District 1 in New Mexico, which centers around Albuquerque. Welcome.
Hi, Susan. It's nice to be with you again.
Of course, you're a former representative, and we've talked to you then. So talk a little bit about why you decided that you wanted to run for Congress.
Well, it goes back a little ways. As you know, I did run for governor, and I sincerely believed that a woman would win, and I was half right. So that being said, I was already back to my life as a DOE contractor. I love what I do. But when Martin Heinrich decided to run in the Senate rather than run for his seat, the possibilities of an open seat just simply don't come along very often. And I truly believe that the citizens of New Mexico had invested in me. I have a great deal of information and knowledge about the legislative process. And so sitting on the sideline really wasn't in my nature. So that's the personal side of it. But we are facing profound problems. And one of the things I learned in Santa Fe was that sometimes it really takes a woman to actually put her finger in the dike to make a difference. And I think I can do that in Washington.
If you go to Congress, you're going to be in the middle of a lot of people. I mean, it's many more people than in New Mexico. And you're not known for listening to what other people tell you to do. So talk about what you think your stance would be.
Well, I would say, so if I'm being accused of having a mind of my own, you would be correct. That is true. So I can make some assumptions. There are caucuses in small legislatures as well as Congress. And it's very much like being in a family. You have to know what it is that you believe. You have to know the people that you're representing. And if you can go along, you should go along to get along. But if there are things that go against my principles or the people that I'm representing, then you have to simply make the decision that you are either going to drag them with you or stand by yourself. And I have done both.
I want to go back to when I think you first started getting involved in community work, and that was in starting the domestic violence shelter in Albuquerque.
You know, I was an intern in this legislature in 1974, and in that year I worked with five incredible women, and we rewrote the Criminal Sexual Conduct Code for the state of New Mexico. Now, we had already opened a rape crisis center, and I was a student senator and vice president of ASUNM. So we had already been on board, and I was working to make sure that there was funding.
Oh, that's what I meant.
And I think back in those days, because the concept of a rape kit, that really came from Albuquerque, even though it was developed in Kentucky. It came from right here. Dr. Kaufman it was still BCMC at the time. And so that's how I got started. And, of course, after we finished that bill was signed into law on March 20th, 1975, and stood the test of time. There were only two small amendments to that bill over 25 years. I learned from Ann Bigman and Betty Reed and Marianne Matthews and Kathy Liebeck and Bob Martin about the value of choosing words very carefully, because it affects people's lives. And that is the standard that I live by.
I remember that as something that you're very proud of.
You know, I am. But once 1975 passed, I got married. John joined the Navy, and I went to California. But it was really surprising because women sought me out even while I was in California, wanting to know what we had done and how we did it. So by the time we arrived in Hawaii, there were many more people saying, how do we do this? We have a problem. And so in Hawaii, the changes to the law were not nearly as sweeping because that was not their culture. But we did open Kapi'olani Women's Hospital's Rape Crisis Center, the very first one in Hawaii. We set up a court monitoring system that was just astounding. And we really had problems. And because women were willing to go and sit in court for those rape cases, things started to change. But one of the other things we did was to open a rape crisis center at Tripler Army Medical Center. And while we all went through this process, we saw the problems. Tripler Army Medical Center was the first rape crisis center that would see men. And in Hawaii, this was an issue.
Well, there is now in Congress the Violence Against Women Act that is up for reauthorization, and there are two different versions of it. One of them includes Native American women and LGBT couples. So where would you stand? Where would you be on that?
Well, first off, I have to tell you, I have not read either version of the bill. So, as you know, before I give you a definitive, I'm going to read the bill. But there's some concepts to talk about. One of the problems about Native American women is being able to deal with a domestic violence issue, period. There are some legal constructs that are really a problem, and so they literally fall through the cracks. And I do know of stories where the tribal police will blow them off, or the county police will blow them off, handing it off to one another. And the truth is nothing happens, and they get literally no protection. The restraining orders mean absolutely nothing. Those are things that I absolutely think that we need to close the gap. The fact that in that community there is so much domestic violence is problematic. And, you know, I think that certainly goes to the high level of unemployment. In terms of treatment of gay and lesbian partners, the fact that there should be an exception, it boggles my mind that there should be any question that domestic violence, I really don't care who it is. In the home, if you are abusing or attacking another home member, I'm sorry, that's wrong. And so I'm looking to make sure that there are some very bright lines there.
Okay, good. I know that you're not pro-choice, but I wonder how you feel about some of the contraceptive issues and Planned Parenthood issues that have come up.
Well, I'd say I am not pro-choice. I am pro-life. That does not mean that I am not in favor of individual responsibility. I think it is appropriate for women to choose when they decide to have a child so that the child is born into the very best environment. And I believe that there is a lot of contraceptives available. The issue that has come up is, should the taxpayer pay for it all the time, or should a woman also stand up to that responsibility? And I think that's where we kind of separate a little bit. I am absolutely for responsible sexual relationships. I am absolutely for family planning, especially within the family. There are things that Planned Parenthood does do. There are some things that I don't like, but the fact that Planned Parenthood also provides services for health-related issues for women on a clinical basis, that's a good thing.
Okay, good. Let's talk a little bit about Social Security and Medicare, which are mostly affect women. Do you think that Social Security is really in trouble and Medicare are in trouble and we need to do something about them? Or do you think that that is trying to get people riled up?
I like to look at the numbers, and they're in trouble. They are in deep trouble. And for me, running for Congress, there is a promise that has been made that is being transferred now to my children. We can't keep that promise if we continue down the path that we're going. With Social Security in particular, one of the things that happened with this trust fund is, it was in 1967, President Johnson actually went to Congress and said, I'd like to take the interest off of this trust fund to help pay down the Vietnam War. Problem is it never went back. There have been some other actions with regard to the trust fund, but at the end of the day, people paid into this trust fund, and it is a trust fund. It's kind of like our permanent fund. If it does not generate the interest, then we cannot sustain the promises that we made. So I really do think it's in trouble.
Okay. And so what would you want to do? What would you propose to do?
So I'm going to ask the question for you. Do I support the Ryan Plan with regard to Social Security and Medicare? I absolutely do. It very clearly says that if you are over 55, you do not need to worry about that promise. We will make sure that we meet that commitment. But I refuse to lie to people under 55, because I know that if we don't make some changes, that will be a false promise. And so what we have to do is we've got to look at, first off, I think we need to pull back any of the interest that is going elsewhere and put it back in the fund. That's the first step. But it's time that we raise the eligibility age. Now, for people who have already planned their lives, is that fair? Of course that's not fair. So we have to do this in a way that people have time to make plans for their lives. And, you know, when they originally created the actuarials for Social Security, you were supposed to be eligible around 62, and you're supposed to kick the bucket about 67, and it was piece cake, except that we're all living longer. And so the number, the amount of money going in doesn't make any sense. And there's one other piece that really has always kind of troubled me. I have always thought that as long as you are working, you should contribute to Social Security. So why there is an arbitrary cap never made any sense to me. But taking the interest off of the fund, out of the fund, makes even less sense to me.
Okay, good. Let's talk a little bit about the Paycheck Fairness Act. The Lilly Ledbetter Act was passed, and now there is another act that is in Congress called the Paycheck Fairness Act, and it would allow employees to talk about what their salaries were. It would, employers wouldn't be able to prevent them from talking, and allows other ways of women to be able to make sure that they were being paid the same as men for the same job.
You know, I have not looked at that particular bill or piece of legislation, but I have an opinion. You know, having been a business owner and a manager, there are a few things that it suggests to me. So I would be looking very seriously at this. Is does it help me create more jobs, or does it prevent me from making more jobs? Now, I have been in the environment where, in fact, a man was hired in an identical position, and he was paid more because he was a man. Now, this was in the early 70s. That ticked me off. And so I am not sure that it is in the best interest of our country, however, for the government to go in and say, please show us your salary scales, because there are people that I may want to hire for specific projects. I'm afraid that it is really going to squelch free enterprise. Well, I would say, but right now, you know, the truth is employees have that right to do that. So adding a layer on top of that bothers me. But I do want to bring up one thing, and I am always amazed that when we look at minimum wage and we look at the fairness doctrine, even with Lilly Ledbetter, why doesn't it apply to the government? And that really upsets me, because I see far more abuses there. As a private business owner, the compliance requirements in terms of fairness, hostile work environment, all of those things that we have worked so hard on actually come to bear in the private sector. And I'm sitting in the government sector going, I can't believe, as a manager, you're behaving like this, and yet we've exempted the government. Hmm. So I will go and look at that bill. My guess is it won't get through the end of this session, so I will get to consider it. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of the pieces I'll be looking for.
Okay? Yeah. Okay. There also are proposals for paid sick leave and for family medical leave do you have ideas about that?
Well, I would say, so are we talking about the private sector or government sector? Because in the private sector, what has happened is in order to make all of this make sense, most companies do not give sick leave. They get paid time off. And it is, are you sick? Are you want to take a vacation? There's no vacation time. There's no sick time. It is all lumped into a general category. So smaller businesses have a harder time giving paid sick leave. And so here's the reality. Mm-hmm. If you are struggling as a small business owner, you yourself don't get to take a paycheck. You really want to keep your employees, but quite frankly, you're not generating enough revenue to do paid sick time. What would you have them do?
I don't think you can ask someone to work full time without any time off, without any sick leave, especially if they, when flu's going around and things like that. I think you want them to be able to stay home and.
Well, I don't disagree. I think most businesses are like that. But I, having done a startup, there are some hurdles to get over before you're able to say to all of your employees, and most businesses do say this, don't come to work if you're sick, because then you make everybody else sick.
Yeah.
And they compensate their employees for that. But to say that all businesses are the same, or that is the standard, I'm not sure we can do that at this moment.
Okay.
But I will look at the legislation.
Okay.
And if it makes sense, if it helps us grow our economy so that we have many more long-term sustainable jobs, then I'm in.
Okay. Good.
You know, Susan, I'm really grateful that we had a chance to talk. And clearly, there are very specific issues for women. But there is an additional perspective. And the reason I wish to go to Congress is we have a debt and deficit that are about to overwhelm all the things that we have worked for. If we are not able to take care of our country, the very special programs, you know, especially, and let me give you an example, the DD waiver program, the care for injured young veterans, we simply will not have the resources. I understand that part. It is not a lot of fun to go in and make those type of fiscal decisions. But one of the things I learned in our legislature is how to do that effectively, but with my heart. And in Congress, I will do that.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
Thank you.